if it dropped, I'd be drowned. But it was very, very good. We were a good crew.
In 1969, Jim Anderson was serving as a second engineer officer on a cargo ship belonging to British India Steam, a division of the P&O company. On arrival in Sydney, he was approached by a Sydney engineer superintendent from P&O, asking him if he would consider a superintendent's position in Melbourne, as they were going to build and run oil rig supply and anchor vessels working out of Barry's Beach in Gippsland. Jim arrived in Melbourne on the 15th of May 1969 after flying in from Auckland. He joined the Lady Astri, which was owned by Dutch interests with a Dutch crew. In his first trip out, he went on a supply boat from Barry Beach, hoisted up to the rig on a basket, then went down to the Lady Astri in the middle of a storm. He remained on the Lady Astri for about 4 months to work and learn what was involved in being on Bass Strait. This is now about 52 years ago. In this series, we're investigating life in the Bass Strait. I'm privileged to have the chance today to speak with a veteran of Australian shipping, Jim Anderson. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you very much.
Tell us about your early career and how you came to be involved in Bass Strait.
I was a marine engineer in a shipping company, British India, and I was approached by the superintendent in Sydney to, if I was interested in a job as superintendent in Melbourne, the start-up of the Australian Offshore Services, building and designing a lot of it, ready to start work in Barry's Beach in the Bass Strait. The shipping company I sailed with was a cargo ship running between Australia, New Zealand and Calcutta. It's a 4 month round voyage. But when we called into Sydney, the superintendent asked me if I'd like the superintendent's job in Melbourne, which was a big step up, okay, which I said yes.
And is that a Calcutta accent you've got there?
A Scottish accent, thanks.
And where are you from originally?
Moffat in Dumfriesshire, in south of Scotland, yes.
When did you first go to sea?
In 1956, as an apprentice with British India. They put me through college, paid for everything, and it was a very, very good apprentice training ship.
What sort of trades did they have you working in those days?
Welding, electrics. Mind you, most of their ships were DC, so AC came later. Blast furnace, they took us to a lot of steelworks. We learned how to turn, how to make screw threads with using the lathe. Everything an apprentice would do. And during the holidays, we didn't get any holiday. We were sent to Drysdale's Pump Works in Glasgow for 3 months. And the second year, we went to Brown Brothers in Edinburgh, who made steering gear and stabilizers for ships. And the last year of my apprenticeship was a year in Swanhunter Shipyard in Newcastle, and watched 4 Doxford engines getting built. It was a good experience and a good apprenticeship.
Did you have any interesting adventures in your early years at sea?
We were kept on a pretty tight line, but I'll tell you one little story. I think it'll be all right now to tell it. But the first voyage at sea on the Chantala, which was a cadet ship, was from Liverpool to Newark in America. And across the bay, there was a American flag on a large flagpole about a kilometre away. And the deck cadets got a Russian flag. And they, in the middle of the night, they rowed across and changed the American flag for a Russian flag, and then beat a hasty retreat when their sirens sounded. That was my first experience at sea.
Gee, that was in the middle of the Cold War.
That was in 1958.
Lucky there wasn't a nuclear response.
I know, yes.
Turning now to your time in Bass Strait, where were you when you got the call offering you the job?
Well, actually, it was actually in Sydney Harbour, and I was down in the engine room, and the chief engineer, could he come up to my cabin? So I went up there, and Jim McGilvery, who was the superintendent engineer in Sydney, asked me if I would like the job in Melbourne. And I said, it's a big step up to superintendent. And I said yes, so but I had to go on to Auckland because they couldn't replace me straight away. So I went to Auckland, and the BI, they were very annoyed, actually, at me leaving, and they flew me to Melbourne. That's where it all started. I still had to do my steam ticket in the chief steam ticket, because I just finished my steam time in the Persian Gulf to Japan run. So I went to the Royal Melbourne Tech and sat my exams there, passed that, and then started in the Bass Strait with the Lady Astrid.
That's quite a long time ago now. You must have been a young man.
Yes, I'm 82.
Tell us about what it was like working with the Dutch crew.
Dutch crew, very, very nice. The skipper was very, very experienced. The chief engineer is very experienced. Showed me everything what the supply boat did, especially the cement, which was a bit of a burden, actually, because they were horizontal tanks. And all the cement was never, ever blown out. And it meant shoveling, which I subsequently changed on the next class. I went to vertical tanks. We had some trouble, remember, reversing, going astern and picking up an anchor chain, a little chain this time, but it got stuck in the propeller blades, and the port gearbox melted all the clutch plates. So luckily we carried spare clutch plates on board.
Jim, tell me the experience of joining the Lady Astrid and going out into Bass Strait.
Well, the first voyage I did was actually on a Smith Lloyd oil rig supply boat, because the Lady Astrid was out at the Ocean Digger. So I went out in the middle of a storm. It was during the night. I think we arrived there about 2 in the morning. I was hoisted out of the bunk, and then they hoisted me up in a rope a platform thing, and they had to climb, hang on the outside in case if it dropped, I'd be drowned, and dropped on board the Lady Astrid's deck, which was heaving up and down, jumped on board, and then I stayed there for 3 or 4 months, and they taught me what an oil rig supply boat did. They also did towing. For such a small boat, they did a lot of towing as well. But it was very, very good. They were a good crew.
Tell us about the crew you were working with. What were they like?
They were Dutch, and Jack Grootveld was the skipper. Very, very experienced. We never had any problems approaching rigs or leaving rigs. The chief engineer was very conscientious, the second as well. And it was a very well-run ship. I enjoyed the Dutch food, completely different to what I was used to, but it was good.
Now, when you're on a supply boat, do you have much interaction with the oil rig crews?
You had to, because it usually between the skipper and the oil rig, and the skipper would tell us they want potable water or drinking water or cement or fuel oil. That was done usually between the skipper and the rig.
I guess you mingled with a motley crew of people when you're out on those ships?
I don't really know. The supply boats I sailed on later on, they were Australian crews, and they were brilliant, because they took turns at cooking, and actually one of the ABs became a skipper on one of the supply boats.
Where was your base when you were going out on those vessels?
In Barry's Beach.
So that's in South Gippsland?
In South Gippsland, yes.
Tell us about Barry's Beach and what it was like in those days.
SO run, a very strict boss. He didn't like the ships alongside, they liked out working. But they were very fair. If you had an engine problem, he gave you time to sort it, and all in all, they were quite fair.
How many weeks at a time would you have been at sea?
Well, being from the office, I did a 4-month stretch, normally it would be 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. But I did 4 months straight just to get to know it, you know. So,
what sort of duties would you have had as a superintendent?
When I first arrived in the office, there was nothing, absolutely nothing. So it had to be started from scratch, including ordering all the spares. The contracts had been signed for the ships, so it was a matter of appointing a chief engineer, which I did, and I got them to stay in a flat in Newcastle, so we had constant 100% supervision, which wasn't the case when I first joined. I went to the naval architects, went through the drawings with them. I took the drawings of the wheelhouse to the masters of the Lady Laura and the lorry and asked them to describe it and how they wanted, where the, especially the after controls were, so that they usually approached the rig going astern. So they redrew the drawings of the wheelhouse, etc., so I could take it back to the naval architects. I had engine room logbooks to design. I had all the equipment to buy. I even bought a spare anchor for the Lady Vera, a spare propeller. And then it was a matter of flying up once a week for 2 days or sometimes 3 days from Melbourne to Newcastle, going through all the contracts with the chief engineer. What does he check today? The alignment of the tail shaft or the gearbox or the engines. How were the engines chocked? Because we did have some trouble with the previous two ships. And basically, right from the word go, from nothing to ship delivery, and signed for them, and off they went.
Tell us about the Ocean Digger rig.
Yes, well, that was spudded in a lot of the wells, and we had to supply a lot of varieties, mud, potable water, drilling water, fuel, gas oil, etc., etc. We had to shift anchors when it moved. We had to pick the anchors up, take them back, and they put them back in their chain lockers, and then the new location, when the satellite sorted them out, we had to run all the anchors out, and they rattled down the deck and just plunged down to the ocean floor into the new position. They soon told you if you hadn't run them out far enough. Anyway, we managed to run them out properly. The Lady Lorne and the Loria had a 100-ton boiler pool, so they managed to run them out the right distance.
Another vessel was the Choctaw. Tell us about that one.
That was a difficult vessel to, because it was always on the move. Anchors to move, the vessel to move, because they laid the pipelines in strings and it came down what they call a stinger, just a platform at the right angle, so they went onto the seabed. And when they finished welding, they had to move it with their own winches and move it up so far. But if they were running out of wire, they had to then ask to get all the anchors rerun. So that was the Aurig supply boat had to be on standby most of the time that was working. We used to take all the pipes out on the Aurig supply boats, and they would load them onto the Choctaw, and then they would lay them horizontally, and there was a series of welders, very skilled welders actually, preheat and then weld the pipes together. And that had to be sealed and checked, and then the pipe would move down into the water, then they weld on another one, move it down into the water, weld on another one, move it down onto the water. And when they needed to be moved further on, the oil rig supply boat had to lift the anchors and move the anchors. And then it re-anchored, and the pipeline started getting built up again. That was the Choctaw.
That was retired seafarer Jim Anderson reflecting on his years working on supply vessels connecting offshore platforms in Bass Strait with their supply bases in South Gippsland on the Australian mainland. We thank Jim and all the other participants in our podcast series for their fascinating stories and insights into the early days of Australia's offshore oil and gas sector. I'm David Goodwin, and this has been the Offshore Shipping Podcast.